This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We greatly appreciate you taking time today to join us for another live edition of Midrats. And because we are live, if you are with the esteemed cohort that makes the extra effort to be here with us. If you scroll down to the bottom of the page, that's where you'll find the chat room. We got Chris Raleigh athwart the quarterdeck. If you want to come join Chris in the chat room and share with us some observations that you might have or some questions you would like for us to direct to our guests during the course of the show, that's a perfect place to do it. And if you've got to run off and take care of some business halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed or you haven't taken the chance yet to subscribe to Midrats, you can go over to iTunes or any of the major podcast aggregators that you might use and subscribe to the podcast. And we will be there for you whenever your busy schedule allows you time to listen. Now let's get on with the show. As everybody who's been here a while knows, I love me a good map. And if geography is destiny, then the city-state of Singapore is a nation of destiny. She sits astride one of the most important waterways, sea lines of communication, however you want to look at it, in the world. And that's not going to change anytime soon. And this is a little city-state that's about one-third the size of the U.S. state of Rhode Island, but it has the population of Denmark. She's, for her size, she really plays an outsized role in a part of the world, the Indo-Pacific region, that is becoming more and more important as the U.S. and Chinese, lack of a better phrase, rivalry continues to gain steam. And today we're going to look at the national security point of view from sunny Singapore. And we have as a returning guest today to discuss this, Blake Herzinger. He's a non-resident WSD Honda Fellow at the Pacific Forum and president of the Singapore chapter of CINSEC. Blake, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really, really excited to be here. And, you know, the Dawn Patrol here in Singapore, I'm going to watch the sunrise. So this is actually going to be a great morning.
Well, if you know better than we do, the sunrises in that part of the world are simply beautiful. And for the listeners, Blake, let's do what I kind of kicked off with, because I do love me a good chart, a good map. And a lot of our listeners may hear about Singapore, may see pictures of Singapore, may have seen it in a movie or two, or just heard the intro of how I described it. But take for a second and talk about Singapore, where she is in the world, and why that makes her and what happens there and the directions that she sees that she needs to go to, what makes that so important to America?
Absolutely. So Singapore, as you mentioned, is a tiny, they call it a little red dot here just at the tip of the Malay Peninsula, and sits astride the Strait of Malacca and the Strait of Singapore, or the Singapore Strait, rather. So that tiny gateway is where most of the oil that's consumed in Asia flows from the Middle East. The amount of goods that flow through is just incredible. You know, I've been seeing the articles coming out of the U.S. that are describing kind of the trade flow backup on the West Coast, and it's showing. I think it said in Long Beach, you know, they said they had maybe 9 or 10 ships parked, and that was for them incredible. Whereas here in Singapore, you know, any time that you fly into Changi International Airport, you'll always see people posting on social media, posting their pictures of the strait, and it's just filled with ships. You know, there are scores of them out there all the time. So the amount of trade and oil that move through here is just incredible. But like you said, you know, this tiny island that doesn't produce a lot is so dependent on that trade continuing. So Singapore has this very, very vested interest, just like the United States, in free trade and the free flow of goods and services. And so that is, I think, one of the biggest points where the United States and Singapore end up aligned, is this existential interest in the continuance of free trade. And so I think a lot of the U.S.-Singapore relationship is built on the recognition of, you know, Singapore knowing that the free sea is the reason that Singapore exists and thrives. And that also is the, you know, the reason for the Republic of Singapore Navy. So you see this small city state with an extremely technologically adept Navy, very modern, very, very high capability levels in a region where traditionally we've seen more emphasis on armies and internal security forces. I think that's kind of the big thing about Singapore that maybe people don't expect is how effective the Navy is and how very interested they are, just like the United States, in keeping the seas open.
One of the things I was reading recently talks about the fact that Singapore has decided to go with the idea that technology is a force multiplier, and that's very important to the way they structure their defense. One of the articles I saw that, in fact, I blogged about was this autonomous mine hunter system they had, and that led me into doing a whole bunch of research on where Singapore is and some of the technology they've developed for their military uses. Can you kind of talk about how they look at this technology and why they're so out front on some of the technologies that are being developed these days?
Absolutely. So throughout Singapore's history, you know, fairly short for a small country as an independent country, they've had pretty contentious relationships with their neighbors. I would say now they're better than they've ever been. But they've had times in the past where continued existence was not always a given. So they've always been very interested in the strong militaries. Lee Kuan Yew, first national leader of an independent Singapore, really invested in a powerful, powerful Navy that had its eye on the future. As we've discussed already, you know, a small country with, for its size, not a tiny population, but obviously not, you know, there's not tens of millions here. So it's generally a conscript military. They do have professionals in the force as well, but they have to be conscious of the fact that numbers are not always a given. You know, it's not a very high birth rate. I believe it's one of the lowest in the world. And so even with a conscript force where every young man serves the country, they only have so many numbers to work with. So they really do lean into technology to try and make up for those shortfalls and to maximize their capabilities. They have a very strong domestic defense infrastructure as well. They produce a lot here in Singapore. The U.S. Marine Corps actually buys Singaporean gear, which is pretty cool. And in recent years, you know, things like AI and unmanned, uncrewed vehicles have been a big part of what they wanted to do. They've done a lot also with unmanned aerial vehicles. One of the partnerships that has been very significant in Singapore's history is with Israel. A lot of the unmanned tech comes from Israel. And then a lot of the training side has been, in the early days, Israeli. The security relationship now with the United States is very, very strong. So you see a lot of really advanced thinking on employing small unmanned vehicles, unmanned vessels. There was just another article this week, actually, about a small unarmed combatant that would be patrolling the Singapore Strait, which is pretty cool when you think about it. I mean, there are some limitations there. Obviously, you're not going to go out and board a ship with an unmanned vessel, but that's where their thinking is. And that's, I think, where we're going to continue to see advances from Singapore. And on the mine laying force, interestingly, you know, moving into the unmanned space, they actually have more manned minesweepers than we do in the United States Navy today.
Yeah, that makes sense when you consider, you know, they it's kind of hard to get out of your little island mini state if somebody has dropped a few mines. They got a nation that small has limited options if somebody decided to play hardball. And you mentioned a bit, and it's kind of when you look at the thumbnail sketch of how Singapore even became a republic, and you mentioned she has had some rough history with her direct neighbors. She actually came into existence in 1965 when Malaysia basically kicked them out, said, "We don't want you." And a lot of that has to do with something else in human history right after geography that can shape not only your relationship with your neighbors, but the direction you go. And I think that it's a point that we should mention, because part of this has to do with the growing rivalry between the USA and China, and that's ethnicity. Now, Singapore is located from mainland China. The southern part of that is Hainan Island. That's about 1,000 nautical miles north. It's the same distance from northeast Florida to the southern tip of Nova Scotia. It's pretty far distant. But last time I looked at it, if you want to look at Singapore from an ethnic point of view, it is 75% ethnic Chinese, with an admixture of Malaysians, South Asians, and a scattering of others, including yourself, mixed in with the population. But kind of their unifying principle, though, I think a few years, it'd be interesting, maybe we can talk about it later, about if this has shifted, but there was a move to, for business purposes, to have more people speaking Mandarin as opposed to English. But English is kind of their lingua franca to unify everybody. But how does that ethnic preponderance of being ethnic Chinese, how does that here in the third decade of the 21st century shape their perspective of things as much as it did in the last century?
So that's a really interesting question. And China has really leaned hard on this idea that Singapore should support China in its, you know, various efforts, both regionally and globally, because so many Singaporeans have that distant link via heritage to China. But in Singapore itself, that, you know, kind of paternalistic tone really doesn't play, and actually has provoked a pretty, you know, not vocal, but visceral backlash with China, because Singapore has worked very hard. And this was one of Lee Kuan Yew's, you know, very forward-looking initiatives, was creating a Singaporean identity. And you know, most of the people that do have an ethnic link to China, you know, their ancestors left China, you know, 100 years ago or longer. You know, they were in, say, you know, Malaya for 150 years. They were in Indonesia. They were, you know, in the Strait settlements here in Singapore. So they not that viewpoint really doesn't get traction here, that they should support the PRC, because people don't see themselves as Chinese first. They see themselves as Singaporean. And they have, you know, that Chinese heritage, which is something that is important to them, but there is a very strong national identity. And building a country on this idea of multiculturalism was something that Lee Kuan Yew enforced. So there are four official languages, you know, all official signages in all four languages. And yes, as you mentioned, that was why they were ejected from the Federation back in 1965, was that, you know, and Malaysia is still kind of governed this way, is that, you know, it's this idea of Malaysian supremacy, essentially, in Malaysia. And that, in Chinese majority Singapore, it just wasn't really going to work. So there's a lot of heritage there. The original Royal Malayan Navy was very engaged in actually fighting in the counterinsurgency against the Chinese communists or the Malayan Communist Party in Malaya through the 60s. So a lot of that early Navy heritage comes from this counterinsurgency role and cutting off the peninsula to support. And then after that, after independence, leading up to and some after, the confrontasi with Indonesia also was kind of this formational experience where, you know, a very, very large power to their south, predominantly Muslim, quite hostile to Singapore, was, you know, probing Singapore. There were pitched battles at sea. So this history of using the Navy to support the state and fend off these larger hostile actors on both on the northern border and into the south still play very strongly in Singapore. And when you go to the Republic of Singapore Navy Museum out at Changi Naval Base, they actually still have, you know, a barrel of demilled weapons that they took from infiltrators coming out from the south trying to get to Singapore. And that history, I think there's probably still some really neat digging to do there. One of my favorite books is called Tiger Territory, and it details kind of the Royal Australian Navy experience working alongside Singapore during the confrontasi. It's quite a thing. It's a very, very interesting history that I think there's still a lot of stories to be told.
How I know that Singapore is part of the regional cooperation agreement on combating piracy and armed robbery against ships in Asia, or RECAP. And I think that's kind of important because there's a whole bunch of countries involved in that. What other local, if you will, regional organizations is Singapore part of that help suppress piracy or terrorists or other things? Are they in a bunch of groups like that?
They are, yeah. And Singapore really, like we discussed, relies on multilateralism and uses its considerable convening power to pull groups together like RECAP. They're very motivated to keep, you know, more countries interested in their own contributions, just because, you know, being small, they sort of have to self-promote a bit to make sure that people are paying attention, and they do a really excellent job. They actually run a what's called the Information Fusion Center out at Changi Naval Base, which is a Singaporean initiative, but it is multilateral. They have international liaison officers from quite a few countries. The exact number is escaping me, but it's probably at least 20. And countries from all over the region essentially send an officer to this kind of like a multilateral watch floor. And they deal with white shipping only. So, you know, they don't deal with the things that might be more controversial that wouldn't allow dialogue between those people, because the PRC also has a liaison there. The United States represents itself. And then most of the ASEAN member states are there at any given time. Some have two, whether they have one from their Navy and one from their Coast Guard. In that center, they look at what's happening at sea, and they have their own domestically engineered common operating picture solution that they've come up with, which is really neat. And they work with industry. They go out, they do visits to shipping companies. They talk about the threats that are out there. And they've used that IFC format to address a lot of piracy events, smuggling. There's some really great case studies that they have of that center pulling off some pretty neat wins at sea. And it's been going, I guess, over a decade now. And it's really kind of the regional gold standard for sharing maritime security information in the region. They participate in the Our Eyes initiative, which is a trilateral maritime security patrol with Malaysia and Indonesia. They participate in the Malacca Strait patrols, which is again a multilateral format for that kind of came into being with the advent of Singapore Strait piracy. So that's a problem that's largely been shut down. It does flare up from time to time. I think every couple of years, everyone sort of preemptively proclaims victory, and then the next year they'll have four or five incidents. It's usually pretty low level. You know, this is not Gulf of Guinea piracy where we see people being killed, or Gulf of Aden piracy where tankers are being held hostage. Usually a team will come on board, steal whatever's not nailed down, and jump off. Occasionally a ship will be taken, kind of pulled out of a shipping lane, and then the pirates will pump off however much gas they can, and then let them go. But it reflects kind of the strength of maritime security in the region, because most pirates or criminals know that they're not going to have very long. So it's really a small window they have to try and get something valuable and get away without being caught, because all the navies in the region, with Singapore in the lead, have really upped their game in terms of interdicting pirate attacks, stopping crime at sea.
I just had the pleasure when I was actually surprised to see him there. There was a Singapore military liaison in Kabul when I was there. I was like, okay, that's fine. I guess everybody shows up once or twice there at HQ ISAF. But we talked earlier about the size of Singapore, and I mentioned population in Denmark. But what's interesting is, because Singapore is from a global standard, it's not only an advanced, it's a prosperous nation. They have a really nice GDP. And when people have spent the last few years looking at NATO in detail, trying to get everybody to claw up to the 2% of GDP minimum, where most of them, I'll use my two favorites, Germany spends 1% if you're lucky, the Netherlands roughly the same. Spunky little Singapore spends 3.2% of their GDP, which their per capita GDP is significant on a global standard. And what that resulted in is, we'll go back to a kind of a benchmark. A lot of people aren't familiar with the Pacific. They may be familiar with NATO nations. So don't take the big NATO nations out of there and get a medium-sized NATO nation like the Netherlands. The Netherlands has a population about three times the size of Singapore. There's 17 million and change. And when you look at Singapore, their Navy is actually, they've got four subs, six frigates, six corvettes, 10 patrol vessels, four amphibs. You mentioned they have more mine countermeasure than we do. We look at our NATO allies, the Dutch, medium-sized power, three times the population, but because of how little they spend on military, the Dutch Navy is actually significantly smaller than the Singapore Navy. The Dutch only have the same number of submarines, but they only have six frigates, four patrol vessels, and a couple of amphibs, but they're missing that little center. So with that significant-sized Navy, are they really hyper-focused on that regional power? Do they have any history or desire to work in a coalition far from their shores, or are they just really focused on their straits, their waters, and their security?
The trajectory of Singapore's Navy is incredible, and as you point out, for their size, they really punch out of their weight class. When they started kind of being cast off from Malaysia, they were, I think they had three little wood boats. Their largest one was a former Japanese mine layer that would later be used as a headquarters. This floating HQ vessel And so from this really modest beginning, you know, with wooden ships, they have built this force step by step, by generation. You know, at first they were a very, very brown water patrol boat force, you know, that was very interested in just keeping their own, keeping their coast free of invaders, you know, not really thinking beyond 12 miles. But now when you look at where Singapore is, you know, in 2016, the Republic of Singapore Navy was the first non-U.S. Navy ship to command a multinational group sail on the way to Hawaii for RIMPAC. So they led a group sail from Asia to Hawaii for RIMPAC. And, you know, they're a steady participant there. They do missile shots at RIMPAC. They have done a number of deployments to the Arabian Gulf. They have done, you know, security cooperation and partner capacity building with Iraq, providing medical assistance. And they have also deployed a number of times to the Gulf of Aden. So in the CTF-151 construct, they've deployed 5 times. They've sent their MPRA, their patrol aircraft, to support Task Force 151. And they've also commanded Task Force 151 5 times. So, you know, as their Navy has grown, you know, their interest and their ability to kind of get further up the supply chain with their Navy and really affect, you know, global flows of trade has been pretty incredible. So absolutely, they're very, very interested in getting farther away from their shores, because I think they recognize, you know, just like the United States and other states that believe in a free sea, you know, if you're focused just on your own, it just won't be enough. You know, you really have to make sure that there's this multilateral framework to ensuring freedom of the seas, and Singapore very much believes in that.
Yeah, I'm looking at their future for their Navy. They've got this plan, and I guess it's in process, this multi-role combat vessel, at least on the books, and it looks incredible and incorporates, as we already talked about, a lot of the AI and fairly modern technology. But I'm going to shift from that to something completely different. Let's talk about the U.S. role in Singapore. I know we have a logistics group there of some kind, and I gather we're by some of their equipment. What other involvement does the U.S. have in assisting Singapore or learning from Singapore about how to operate in the conditions that Singapore sits in?
Yeah, so Commander Logistics Western Pacific is the main command in Singapore, U.S. command in Singapore, and as you mentioned, you know, really careful that it's a place and not a base. So when U.S. forces were, you know, when our lease was not renewed in the Philippines, Singapore quietly opened the door to the United States to move here. So they did, and from Command of Logistics Western Pacific, you know, they coordinate movement of all the supply vessels and USNS ships throughout the Indo-Pacific. So it's a critical command. They do a lot of the theater security cooperation, so leading the exercises that the United States participates in from here. And they're, you know, not large by any stretch of the imagination. You know, it's not a like a Norfolk waterfront by any means, but the intent was at one time to have 4 LCS here, which I know is a favorite hobby horse on this particular podcast, and one of my own as well. You know, we've watched the LCS unfortunately not really materialize the way we'd hoped, but we have had successful single LCS deployments to Singapore that have been used in a number of different operations and exercises. Last year, the very, very public USS America deployment down to kind of observe and keep an eye on the Chinese harassment of the Malaysian drill vessels or oil exploration vessels. And that was also supported by a Singapore-based LCS. So that was good to see. You know, it'd be better if we had four, but we'll take one if we can get it. The other things that the U.S. does from here, the United States is Singapore has very generously offered use of one of its airbases for P-8 flights out of Singapore. So that's something that's happened quite a lot over recent years, and that's a great point of cooperation for our two forces, and something that helps us get used to, you know, working together and gets both sides used to, you know, how the other works. And, you know, just one note that, you know, Singapore, their Navy, which, you know, a second, you know, favorite topic of the podcast, you literally could eat off of any surface in the ships. It is just an impeccably maintained Navy. So it's not just that they're leaning forward into the, you know, future technology in their ship design, things like that, but the ships themselves just sparkle. They look brand new. They practically have new car smell when you go on board. It's pretty amazing. You know, the U.S. Singapore relationship has also had the CARROT exercise that we've done together for a long time. So cooperation, afloat readiness and training. And that has matured into a high-end exercise called Pacific Griffin. And the United States and Singapore conduct Pacific Griffin now together. So it's kind of on this, upward trajectory, practicing higher-end warfare tech, TTPs, and really getting into things that go beyond the scope of the original exercise. You know, really, how would we really work together at sea and doing, you know, the fun stuff. So they do missiles. We do missile shots at Pat Griffin. We do things like that. So it's pretty cool.
Kind of a unofficial international organization is, and different people use it for different definitions and contexts. But there's more to it than appears at first, and that's the Anglosphere. One manifestation of that for those intel military guys is Five Eyes, which. Is the U.S., U.K., Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Basically, the Anglosphere is a collection of former British possessions of one flavor or another. And Singapore clearly is part of that because it's a secondary byproduct of the British Empire. But in her neighborhood, you have other former British possessions, other either primary or secondary members of the Anglosphere. You have Bangladesh, India, Malaysia, Burma, and Australia and New Zealand as well. When you look at those nations nearby who share that, to varying degrees, touchstone of the British Empire, how would you rack and stack their relation with those nations from not just a military but an economic and, to some extent, cultural connection?
Yeah, so that is a really multifaceted question. I will try and get at that in the best way that I can.
Yeah,
think to do it. So,
five-hour show by itself, but
yeah, it is. So Singapore is a very, very strong proponent of ASEAN, so the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And that is sort of its organizing principle for a lot of those countries, for its engagement with a lot of those countries. You know, ASEAN exists on this non-interference principle, encourages dialogue, and that is to kind of keep down a lot of formerly fairly acrimonious relationships. You know, Singapore, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, you know, they've had serious, serious problems in the past, and today, you know, they're generally cordial. I think every once in a while it can still get a little bit prickly. I'd say that's putting it diplomatically. You know, for their entire lifetimes, you know, the former prime minister in Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, and Lee Kuan Yew hated each other. And that was like, that defined relations. You know, those two gentlemen really did not like each other. And Mahathir would go out of his way to really stick it to Singapore wherever he could. And he's still around. You know, he was just in power again. The man is in his 90s and he's still, you know, plodding away and taking charge in Malaysia. Recently lost power, but I mean, it's pretty incredible. And when he came in, you know, it was still some of the same politics. It was kind of this blaming Singapore for some of Malaysia's problems and, you know, hassling Singapore on the maritime boundaries. And so it was kind of this blast from the past. But ASEAN, I think, is the first way that Singapore interfaces with a lot of those states like Myanmar, like Malaysia. Although this recent round of, you know, the recent coup in Myanmar, Singapore has been at least somewhat outspoken on that, which is good to see. It also creates kind of an interesting problem for ASEAN because, you know, non-interference is a big thing for them, but it also creates a problem for ASEAN because, you know, in 2021, they can't just watch the Burmese military, the Thammudaw, they can't just watch them crush another democratic government like they have several times in the past. You know, that just isn't going to fly now. So the organization is going to have to think of a new way to deal with that. Aaron Connolly actually wrote a really provocative piece for the IISS on that recently. So Singapore is very willing to use its diplomats to say what it needs to say. And they do that with the United States as well. There have been a number of times in recent years where Singaporean diplomats have told the United States, you are pushing too hard on this region with regard to China. And I think that's something that we always have to remember is that, you know, whatever is happening in the dyad between the United States and China, you know, that competition will play out in Southeast Asia, but Southeast Asia is not just a, you know, a vacuum that we can fill with this competition, right? It is a dynamic, vibrant region. It's one of the world's largest markets. And the countries here have to live here, right? If the United States tomorrow decides it doesn't want to compete with China anymore, you know, Singapore is still going to be here. They still have to deal with China. They still have to trade with China. And so, you know, there is no functional choice here. There's no falling into the U.S. camp for Southeast Asia, 100%. So you'll see all the countries here balancing both with one another, because there still are some suspicions and security dilemmas and things like that in the region. And then they will also balance between the United States and China. So there's always a lot of politicking going on across the region, depending on what's happening.
How involved, if at all, is Singapore in the, what I would call the fish wars of Southeast Asia, where so much of the culture and the livelihood and actually the subsistence of a lot of the countries around the South China Sea are dependent on fishing, and China seems to dominate that. Is Singapore involved in any way in resisting China's efforts, as, say, the Indonesians or the, to a certain extent, the Philippines are?
They're not, because their EEZ is tiny. They're really sandwiched in between Malaysia and Indonesia. There is no real fishing industry in Singapore to speak of. You could count their fishing vessels, their flagged fishing vessels, on one hand. And they're not a South China Sea claimant like many of the others. So, but they have taken a very principled stance on a free sea, an open sea, freedom of navigation. Although Singapore has not participated in things like freedom of navigation operations, they have been vocal in supporting maintenance of the current regime of international law at sea. Actually, there's a great case study for the success of the Information Fusion Center that we were talking about that actually centers on fishing boats. There was a vessel that came in into the region and actually tried to get from Singapore to Indonesia while proclaiming itself as a fishing vessel, a Singapore flagged fishing vessel in AIS. And the Indonesian, I think it was Bakamla, which is the Indonesian Coast Guard, possibly their Navy, saw the vessel coming, saw what it was broadcasting in AIS, basically looked down at the display and then looked up at the ship and recognized that it wasn't one of Singapore's, you know, four fishing boats, said that is not a fishing boat. So hauled them in, ship was packed with methamphetamine. So really interesting highlight on, you know, the importance of technical tools at sea, but also, you know, walking the beat and being out there, understanding what is normal. The fact that these Indonesian sailors could look at the ship and say, well, no, I know the four Singaporean fishing boats, and that's not one of them, kind of gives a little vignette into how small their interest in fishing is, as well as the proximity of the countries here. You know, from my house, I can see islands that belong to Indonesia. I can see part of the shipping lane, you know, from the balcony. So it's definitely compact.
I had to kind of giggle. You know, we talk about clash of cultures. You know this better than I do. Singapore is a rule of law kind of place. I get the Singaporeans are good attention to detail. And if you have a law in the books, especially about chewing gum that everybody knows, you best pay attention to it because they're going to hold it to you. I guess that plays out on the international scene as well. You said something earlier that I wanted to go back to, and it folds in with a question, I think, that Chris asked in the chat room. Is, you know, you made a little comment before, you know, if America decides it doesn't want to compete with China, and from a rip from the headlines type of thing, there was a very interesting statement from Representative Adam Smith. For those that don't know, he is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And I'm going to do a little quote here for you from Congressman Smith. Quote, "I'm worried that we are running towards the idea that the only way to deal with China is to build a military that is large enough to dominate them. I think that's a mistake. I think it's unbelievably expensive, unnecessarily provocative, and also in the modern era of warfare, pretty much impossible. We are not going to get to the point of having a military that dominates China. It's just not going to happen, period." So that little throwaway line of yours, I think people need to take a deep breath and think about it, because if the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee is not an influential person who says things by accident. So if you pull that thread and if you look at where Singapore is, and we're talking about how important that strait is, Chris's question is the traffic, specifically the, lack of a better phrase, oil traffic, petroleum byproducts, whatever you want to do, is that traffic more of the in the interest of the People's Republic of China or the United States? Is our level of focus concern on that in excess of its actual direct economic impact on us vice mainland China?
So if I understand the question correctly, so is the traffic coming through Singapore going mostly to China? Is that more the gist of it?
Yeah. And, you know, if the U.S. decided to go, we don't need this big competition, you know, whatever, so we're not going to be involved in the Indo-Pacific, we're just going to let China worry about it. If things go south in the straits, availability point of view, is that more of an impact and a concern in China than it is the United States?
Well, I think the question frames it in a way that I wouldn't. I don't think U.S. involvement keeps the strait open. You know, there's no U.S. involvement is keeping the seas free in Singapore because Singapore is doing that. China, in terms of U.S.-China competition, definitely views Singapore as a vulnerability because, you know, the majority of the fuel that is driving their economy comes through here. I would say that is not, you know, the case for us. Obviously, in the United States, coming from a place where we can be energy independent. So Singapore presents a problem for China, and we've seen a number of ways where they've tried to deal with that. They've tried to diversify away from relying on Singapore. They've tried to invest in pipelines. They've tried to invest in a lot of things that lessen that vulnerability. The problem is presented if talking about, you know, the U.S. determining it doesn't feel like competing with China, is in the security dynamics of the whole region, really, because for, you know, the long Asian peace has been undergirded by the U.S. security guarantee. And, you know, with a few notable exceptions, you know, the peace is largely held. And the U.S. security guarantee was this gold standard. You know, we have treaty allies out here, Philippines, and then, you know, to a lesser extent, Thailand. And then obviously once you get above Southeast Asia, you know, Korea and Japan, and going further south, you have Australia. And those relationships have really meant a lot. In recent years, I think some of those relationships have changed in ways that, you know, maybe we appreciate, maybe we don't. There are things that maybe we don't understand about how Southeast Asia in particular has changed, you know, with the rise of China, and then the United States electing not to go forward with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China and ASEAN have gone forward with the RCEP, the regional the acronym is escaping me, but essentially RCEP is a regional trade agreement that ASEAN drove and China is a member of. The United States is not a member of that. So we've kind of missed out on the chance to set the rules in terms of economic relationships. You know, there's been some talk about trying to drive some free trade agreements into the region, but, you know, that's going to be tough because most of these countries are thinking multilaterally on trade and we are not. So we're losing leverage there in terms of economic participation. And that's what the region really wants. You know, the security relationships are great, but people want to make money. You know, that's the dream. People want their populations to get rich. And that's what people want. You know, they want a better life for themselves and for their family. And so if the United States is not going to be part of that, then we're going to see our influence continue to flag in the region. Evan Feigenbaum has put forward this concept of the United States as the Hessians of Asia. And I think that is increasingly apt, unfortunately, is that we overweight our security contribution and we're missing the forest for the trees. We're missing what everyone's saying. You know, we'd really like to see the U.S. think more about, you know, economics and investment. And we are a very, very large investor in the region. We are, you know, the number one source of FDI in a lot of places. But, you know, China is the largest trading partner and that's not changing. And we're not doing enough from the United States side to grow those partnerships. You know, we're kind of marching along, while the region surges forward with these sweeping multilateral agreements.
That kind of raises an issue that we see with Australia and New Zealand and some other countries that have had and currently have, I guess, trading agreements with China. But every time they pop up with something that China doesn't agree with, China reacts by threatening or actually cutting off their purchases of materials from particularly Australia, I guess. And how about the other countries down there, and Singapore being one of them? I mean, do they have enough trade with China that if they pop their head up and say, you know, we don't agree with your treatment of the Uyghurs or whatever, that, you know, they too will be punished by China?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And China's been very willing to wield influence in a lot of creative ways. You know, looking at Northeast Asia, you know, hammering Korea when South Korea was talking about THAAD, you know, essentially a boycott of Korean companies in China, cost Korea billions, you know, cutting off rare earth metals to Japan. One very public incident in Southeast Asia was Singapore was coming back from an exercise that it conducted yearly with Taiwan, a military exercise. And China seized Singaporean military equipment from a cargo vessel that pulled into Hong Kong, these Terex fighting vehicles. And this was a big deal. You know, that's like, you know, we're dealing with some serious questions of sovereignty there. And China impounded them. And they said, oh, no, it was an inspection, of course. And there were questions on the, you know, the bills of lading. But it was a very clear signal to Singapore, you know, we don't appreciate you doing these exercises with Taiwan. And Singapore does a lot of things like this. You know, they have to exercise outside of Singapore for a number of reasons. You know, there's not a lot of space to do an exercise here. You know, I think we have, you know, artillery ranges in California that are larger than Singapore. So, you know, you've got to get out if you want to do things. You know, if you're trying to turn and burn and do some sort of air-to-air exercise, you're going to be out of airspace pretty quickly in Singapore. Yeah, my home state, Idaho, actually hosts a Singapore Air Force squadron at Mountain Home, which is something that I love to hear. I love hearing about what they're up to. Singapore has invested heavily in Australia to send its military down there to exercise. So they do a lot of things like that. But to get back to the question, absolutely, the entire region is extremely vulnerable to Chinese pressure. Philippines complained that China wasn't doing much to help with a typhoon years ago. And they essentially boycotted Philippine bananas and just let fruit rot on the pier. They've got, you know, hooks in everywhere, and they've got plenty of influence and plenty of leverage, and they're not afraid to use it. And so these are places, you know, where the United States could be stepping in and providing, you know, an outlet for these markets. You know, hey, Australia, New Zealand, China's not buying, you know, your Pinot Noir, great. Send it to the United States. We'll buy it. You know, setting up some kind of pressure relief valve, I think, would be a great step. You know, like-minded economies that are willing to kind of soak up some of that excess when China tries to really turn the screws on countries to ensure their obedience with China's whims.
Small nations with challenging geography often face a lot of insecurities, you know, beyond just physical insecurity from larger nations. It just has to do with basically living. And for an island nation, having a strong Navy and having access to it is critical of that. And when Singapore looks at your typical group of insecurities, I read a while ago that, you know, in recent history, you know, access to fresh water was a big challenge in Singapore, but they did a pretty good job in diversifying their sources and making sure they had access to fresh water that they would need for the variety of purposes, not just drinking. But there are other insecurities that nations similar to Singapore and even larger nations face. There's food insecurity, energy insecurity, and even, you know, that border security with, you know, you mentioned earlier, Malaysia and Singapore had some issues with whose border lies where. when they rack and stack their insecurities, whether it's from a lack of diversity of sources or access to them, what are those highest areas of insecurity Singapore faces?
So a lot of the issues that are faced throughout Southeast Asia are faced by all, but usually in a different rack and stack based on where you're standing. So Singapore is largely immune to a lot of the extreme weather patterns, things like that. But, food security is something that Singapore has really worked hard to insulate themselves from, being small and without a lot of arable land. The global supply lines have to stay open. And a lot of Singapore's security concerns depend on that. It's food, it's gas, it's oil. If those things stop for a day, Singapore's in trouble. They've really invested. Even actually COVID has highlighted some of these things, and they changed the way they did business. Because obviously when global supply lines slowed down, you had panic buying in Singapore. You had people cleaning out shelves, buying all the rice, buying all the cooking oil. So Singapore actually did something pretty clever. They kind of highlighted the strategic reserves that they've built. And they did some news stories on them. They were pushing out supplies from those into the mall so you could see it, kind of helping reassure the public, like the government's thinking about these things. This doesn't catch us by surprise. We're ready. So Singapore prides themselves on thinking way into the future. So a lot of those issues, they at least have a plan in place. Climate change, rising seas, that's something that Singapore is concerned about. I've heard that there's at least a planning cell that's working on the question of this. I mean, this is fascinating to me. What if global sea levels rise so far that the Singaporean population becomes a diaspora? What if Singapore is no longer inhabitable? How does the nation survive if we have to go somewhere else? So that's pretty interesting, for a government to be thinking that far in advance, because that's not any of our lifetimes. But that's something that they're wargaming now. What if we have to go? Where do we go? How do we make ourselves still a viable state from somewhere else? So those are the things that they do. They've really leaned into things like we've talked about already, like AI, the smart cities initiative that they have. Terrorism is always a concern. During the Confrontasi, terrorism was a very real thing in Singapore. They put several terrorists to death here. In the 90s, there was some Al-Qaeda, Jemaah Islamiyah associated terrorism that targeted Singapore. There were the successful attacks in Bali, things like that, and there were aspirational attacks here in Singapore. The U.S. Navy, actually, the GMT online still highlights one of those where they were doing some pre-attack surveillance on the U.S. facilities here. So that's always, that's like the one time that I really pay attention to the computer-based training is when I see the place that I work pop up on the terrorism awareness training as something that, Al-Qaeda was looking at. And that still pops up now and again. You'll see someone who's been arrested for possessing, terrorist propaganda, and then, they subsequently disappear into a dark hole from whence I assume they never emerge. Things like foreign interference, espionage, those are things Singapore takes very, very seriously because they do pride.
I think Blake disappeared on us.
Saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me and so best friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweet.
Hey, Blake, is that you calling back in?
It is, yeah. Sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened.
Well, I don't know if you heard, but I already started the post show, and I actually did the post show with my mic off, so there's going to be a little dead space there. Maybe to keep me humble, I'll leave that there on the replay. Maybe I'll edit it out, but we'll find out. That's one of the exciting things about live radio. But usually we wind up the show, Blake, with we like to ask our guests, where people can go if they wanted to keep an idea about what you find interesting and important or things you might be producing, and what topics in the future do you think you're going to be concentrating on?
I'm keeping pretty busy right now. So I'm working on two co-authored projects with a friend of mine, Jerry Doyle. We're working on a book about the DF-21 Delta and China's anti-ship ballistic missiles. And then I'm working on a maritime security primer with three co-authors that I admire greatly. So John Bradford, John Odom, and Alessio Patilano. So really excited about those projects, and hopefully we'll be tying those off this year. But as ever, you know, I remain really interested in, you know, kind of where the United States is going out here in the Indo-Pacific. I'm very keen to see what happens with the Pacific Deterrence Initiative. And so I've been part of kind of a sub-initiative here on maritime security for several years now. And I think the PDI is really, you know, the future. You know, I think we saw what the European Reassurance Initiative did for Europe. And I really hope that we see something similar out here. I think that investment is extremely, extremely welcome, and we're in dire need of it. So excited to see where that goes, and I'll be watching closely, and I hope I'm involved. That's what I'd like to be doing from out here.
Well, I got thrown off, but I'm back. I just wanted to say thank you for being on with us, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you again, Blake. We'll have to have you back again.
Thanks so much for having me, gentlemen. I couldn't have asked for a better way to start the day, and it's always a pleasure.
And have a great Singapore day there. Blake, and thank you again, everybody, for putting up with our last-minute technical issues. And until next time, we'll try this again. Hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Eat some good Singapore curry for me.
You got it.
Thank you.
Saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave this friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Farewell, Leicester Square.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.